Thank you. So we're going to talk about Albert Einstein. He was born March 14, 1879, in Germany. I'm just kidding. The title is interesting and may even be relevant to what I'm going to speak about. We'll find out in a second, or more than a second. But first, in terms of the topic that I decided to speak about, it was inspired by something that actually happened to me in the past, not this year. I'm purposely saying that some people here will understand why. A conversation that I had with Talmud, and it was about Shana Bet. Now, it was about encouraging him to come back to Shana Bet. It was a Talmud who had been doing beautifully. He had done so well, and he was just perfect almost in every way. But, you know, obviously even perfect people need further development. And he was learning so well and really picking up on Ian and his skills, and he was very smart, and he was showing very good midos, and he was becoming a Ben Torah. I said, "Wow, you know, you're going to really be solidified. Come back, Shana Bet. It's perfect for you." And I really don't commonly do that. I don't usually encourage, pressure people to do Shana Bet. I might suggest it when it's applicable, but, you know, I don't generally pressure people, right? Except for Evan and Noah. Those are the only exceptions. But other than that, I really don't. So, with him, I felt it was exceedingly important that he come back for whatever reason, and it was a lock. He said, yeah, for sure. Pre-Pesach, he was definitely coming back. He goes back for Pesach, and, you know, it's always a challenge to go back for Pesach. He comes back to Yeshiva and totally changes his mind. He was definitely coming back to Shana Bet, and now he was definitely not coming back. It wasn't even a discussion. He almost went the other way when he saw me coming. He didn't want to talk about it. It's not happening. So I said, okay, fine, I'm not going to pressure you, right? I will pressure you, but I won't pressure him, I said, and I'd like to know, just for my own education and understanding, what made you change your mind? And what he told me was the following. He said, 100% he was committed to coming back. He then sat down with his family, including his brothers, and he sat down to discuss the fact that he was very, very enthusiastic about coming back to Shana Bet. And then they opened up his eyes, because they said to him, they said, wait a second, you know, and he had three brothers that had been there at Yisrael, did very well, and only in Shana Aleph, right? And they said to him, no, you got to understand, let's give you a better perspective on what the year in Yeshiva and Yisrael is. And they educated him. And what did they educate him to understand about this experience of coming to Yeshiva and Yisrael for a year? That it serves a purpose, a very important one, which they enjoyed very much, and they got a lot out of it. But its purpose is to gain certain things, skills, perspective, understanding of your religion, etc., etc., in order, as a preparation, to move forward when it's time to get back to real life. And the real world. The real world and real life, you know, that's something that's the time has come for you to focus on. You get everything you can out of your Shana Aleph in Eretz Yisrael and take it with you and, you know, let's use it in the real world. And he must have expressed this concept of the real world and real life three or four times. So, you know, I said, okay, I wasn't going to fight him on it, and he was convinced of it, and he was positive of it, and, you know, I'm still in touch with him, Baruch Hashem, he's doing okay. I honestly think that he would be doing unbelievable if he would have come back to Shana Bet, but he's doing okay, and that was that. But it got me thinking, I said, you know, it's not only Talmidim or the brothers of Talmidim that promote this idea that there's something called real life that's in the real world that's out there that's in the future that we're going to work on, and this is not really that. This is something else. And it got me thinking, and maybe I have too much time on my hands. Oh my. But I started to scroll through the YU Torah Shraga section looking at all the titles of the shmuzin that have been said here over the past few years. I thought it would be a good exercise. You know, maybe, again, I have too much time on my hands, I'm crazy. But it would give me some insight into something. So, as is not necessarily a surprise to anybody, there's a certain predictable pattern to our shmuz titles and content, for that matter. Right? So, for example, at the beginning of the year, right, these would be the typical, these are actual titles. Charging up for the beginning of the year. Rabbi David, right? Excellent. You can definitely guess who this is. Opening shmooze, just do it. Rabbi Yudin, right? 8 strategies for a successful Rosh Hashanah and upcoming year, right? So all of them, basically the same thing, right? Because it's the beginning of the year, and it's very predictable, and it's very appropriate that it should be the title. Then we get to the middle of the year, and the titles there focus now on a different emphasis, right? They're going to focus now on something like momentum and consistency. And here we have the following titles. This is also easy to guess who this is. Do you want to be average or start a streak?
Fine, Sheriff.
Making an impact through consistency. That was me. This was the two that seemed to contradict each other. Remember that little back-to-back? Right? But basically the theme's the same. And then another one, pass your test and become great. Right? So we could see the middle of the year, that's everything's predictable, right? You know, we have the beginning and the middle. And then I do have to admit, there are certain unpredictable titles that come in that, you know, I bet you can't guess who said these. For example, there's, and it's usually when there's a special topic that wants to be highlighted. So the topic here was personal development. So the real you and the muddy chicken. Okay. Lessons from the dogs. Or sometimes when we want to learn about the world and the topic is the world, there are other creative titles. Who's holier, the Tibetan monk or the Chinese waiter? Or how the backward nuns changed history. What do you think that one's about? Nuns. Should be nuns, not nuns. Or great insights into relationships. I love you, but I can't marry you. Or I don't dislike you. So these titles all fall into the sort of like catchy kind of title idea. Let's get some attention to the topic and then they take off from there. But for the most part, with those exceptions, all the titles were very predictable and they're very, very much consistent. When I looked, comparing year to year, we are very appropriately focusing at the beginning of the year on getting charged up and going, on the middle of the year keeping the momentum and the consistency, and finally, at the end of the year, like now, and this is where I think we're going to see that the Rebbeim, including myself, are almost guilty of the same preconceived notion that the Talmid brothers were, I think, guilty of. And at the end of the year, we have the following titles. As we wind down the Zman, what are you taking with you? Making Torah a part of your real life. Leaving yeshiva, what to pack and what to leave behind. Or preparing for real life in the real world. Oh my God, I said to myself, no, this isn't just an issue with some, you know, sort of like inexperienced young Talmidim or their siblings. This is really the perception. And I was saying to myself, well, you know, is that really true? Is this a true way to understand this year some sort of like unreal life? This is not real. This is some preparatory thing. And the real life's out there. Is that really the way to understand it? Is it true? So I said, in the Rabbi Shavuot's spirit of nonconformity, I'm going to challenge that premise from top to bottom. The premise is incorrect. I'm going to try to demonstrate to you that this idea is a horrible perspective and it is against what is in every one of our best interests. We are not to think of it this way. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Where does the idea come from? And, you know, I got to tell you, I was like mulling this over with my wife. I said, you know, I think I want to talk about this topic because I think this is ridiculous. I think it's a big misconception and it's very harmful. And I think that I could take it to a place where I could give a perspective that's going to be very useful. And my wife's like, looking at me like this, which usually means, why are you making such a big deal out of this? What are you talking about? It's not such a big deal. And I began to doubt myself. And then when I was exploring the topic, I found 15 years ago, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, spoke about this exact topic. It was exactly what bothered him, and I felt I was in very good company. And now, of course, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, when he talks about something, so he does it in a certain sophisticated manner. And he approached it, right, in a way that I think will open up the discussion and get to a perspective that I think is much healthier. I just want to emphasize why this is such a big deal is because, you know, when we call something real life, as in contrast to another life, the life that we're all having here, what are we saying about this life? This life, this year, our experience this year is virtual, some kind of virtual reality, right? And everyone knows this 2016 is the year of virtual reality, right? You guys know that? That's out there, right? This is the year where virtual reality, chas v'chalila, is going to take over. Virtual reality is a very dangerous thing. Everyone knows that, right? I think you should... does anyone know anything about virtual reality, or am I assuming? Virtual reality is something where a computer, right, takes over all your sensory input, which means that it's going to give you what you see, what you hear, what you feel, and that is going to recreate a new reality, or create a new reality. Is that what yeshiva is? Is that what we do? You know, we're not reality, we're virtual. Like virtual reality, is that what it means? Chas v'chalila. Because virtual reality, many, many studies are out now showing how dangerous, and this is an aside, but I'm telling everybody, be careful when they start selling these virtual reality, you know, helmets that go right on your iPhone. They are extremely dangerous. There's a lot of psychological literature out there telling about how difficult it is to come back to normal, real reality. But that's an aside. Is it true that yeshiva is virtual reality? So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, when he, you know, I just want to make one more statement as to why this issue is so personal and important to me. My own mother is also in the camp of calling the world over there, in America, let's say, or back in your original lives, that's the real world. Like, whenever I'm in America, let's say, doing my doctor stuff, so my mother will say to me when we start a conversation, hey, how's life? Here, when my mother talks to me, how's Disneyland? When are you coming out of vacation? When are you coming back to the real world? This mom is my own mother. So, you know, whom I love dearly, but I know that she sometimes listens to white color stuff, so I'm hoping she's listening. Because, Ma, this is for you. Now, let's get back to Rav Aaron. So Rav Aaron asked the exact same child. He said, why do they call that real life and this not real life? Why? So Kedarko, he quotes C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis was an Irish Catholic writer, philosopher, very well known, very incredibly insightful person. You read Rav Aaron quotes him a lot because he's got great insight into religion. He's a very religious person. And if you stay away from, let's say, his Christian bias, if you get to his neutral, pure spiritual stuff, it's unbelievable. And this is no exception. So he quotes C.S. Lewis and says the following. In a book that's called Studies in Words, so he's interested and focused on the definitions of words. The words he's interested in is this expression, real life. So he says the following. When a person speaks about real life or the real world, he refers to those elements of life which he personally values most highly. Thus, for example, many people relate to a business deal or other material acquisition as an expression of real life, while writing poetry or engaging in philosophy are not worthy of that dignified title. Right? What's real life mean? So he's beginning to open up and understand. People call real life, where does that expression come from? That's the real world, that's the real life? They're giving away their own bias. That's what they think is the most important thing. That's all it is. And he takes this even further, and he goes on, and he says, what's the source of this mistaken distinction between the real world and the not real world? It's found in, quote, the deeply ingrained yet arbitrary convictions of narrow minds that whatever they themselves are chiefly interested in is the only thing that is real. Right? It's an amazing thing.
What is he saying? He's saying, you know where this whole concept comes from? That the real world is that ultimate world here.
We're going back to when we leave places like this and experiences like this. It's because, you know, to them, the only things that are real, the things that they hold are going to be of significance. So, at the end of the day, he concludes that for these people, gaining material acquisitions, and let's say social status, that's the real world. Everything else is not part of the real world. Everything else is less. So that, of course, is stupid. Right? We all know that's absurd. Right? It shouldn't make sense to anyone. And on top of that, who do we want defining the real world and real life? Narrow-minded, stupid people? Who is the only one qualified? Who is the only being qualified to define life and the world? Who? I'll give you an example if you don't get it right away. Right? Omega Man. Who heard of Omega Man? Anyone? Omega Man is very interesting. Omega Man was a real-life person. You can Google this and check me up on it. He was known as the greatest forger in the history of mankind. And by the way, it's Omega Man or woman, because they never found out who it was. What did he do? There was a certain coin. It's called the Double Eagle 1933 $20 coin. Something like that. I don't remember exactly. A very special coin. He managed to forge it in a way, listen to this, he forged it so well, he counterfeited that coin so well, that not only was he getting away with selling it to experienced sellers, but the dealers liked it so much that even when it was known to be a counterfeit coin, it was such a good copy, such an exact replica, they paid him thousands of dollars for the known counterfeit coin. Now that's culture, right? This guy's made it in the world of counterfeit. He is the master. So it was so good. How did anyone find out that he was counterfeit? How did anyone find out? So he was such a wise guy or woman. Again, no one really knows what he was or who he was. He started sending the hint. He was having such a good time with this that he put into the sign. And I have a picture over here if anyone wants to see this. In the coin, he puts, he's called Omega Man, because he puts a little omega. Omega is from the Greek alphabet, it's a little letter. He put it that you could only see it with a microscope. So the only way that anyone ever knew the difference between the real coin and the counterfeit ones was because he, the designer of the coin, told you that by microscope you could tell that this is a fake one, otherwise it was identical. So what's the lesson? It's a cute little story, but what does it have to do with what we're talking about? It's obvious. Who's the only one to define something that's been created? Who's the only one who can do it? The creator, the designer. Who's the creator of the world and the designer of life? Kadosh Baruch. So if I want to know what's real life and what's not real life, the only interest I have is what does Kadosh Baruch say? What does he say? So, no, fortunately, he says, in Avos Terebi Nosa, it's explicit. It defines real life. There's a statement. It says the following. Eila nikra chayim. The following are real life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Dekosu v'Hashem Elokim emes, hu Elokim chayim. Torah. Nikras chayim. Shneemar. Etz chayim hi l'machazik imbo v'samchay ha'meusha. Yisroel Bidvekus with Hashem, Nikru Chayim, Shemar Batem, Advekim Bashem, Elokechem, Chayim Kuchem Hayom. Tzadik Nikru Chayim, Shemar Pri Tzadik Eitz Chayim. So Hashem, King of the Torah, obviously, is defining real life. So what is real life? In a word, what is real life? What is really real life? Well, real life is whatever circumstances you have to be in, you are sort of going to make it real if you, in the, when you're subject to whatever events you're subject to, when you're subject to whatever environment you're subject to, whatever you're up to, you're looking to establish a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu through the Torah. That's real life. It's very interesting. So what does that mean on a practical level? What exactly are we saying here? Now, people can make a mistake, because people might think, you know what real life is? When, according to Avos Terebi Nosa, according to Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know what it is? It means keeping halacha, being shomer Torah mitzvahs. Well, that, of course, would be a big mistake if you think that's all it is. Of course, it is that. But that's a big mistake a lot of people make. It's limited. It's limited to adhering to Isser Vehetir, to adhering to Allah. Because the Torah has a second or equal agenda along with it. And that is, the Torah imparts not only the rules, right? But it also is imparting an entire value system. The Torah is trying to get us to go beyond just worrying about, you know, specific halachos. Now we must do. There's some else is very important. But the Torah, at the same time, if you want to live a true Torah life, it has to affect your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions, all of them, your attitudes. There's something called the Torah attitude that goes beyond just worrying about it. Just to make sure, I want to make sure you understand how important this is. My good friend was just telling me he went on a vacation after a lot of deliberation. He decided, he's a very sharp guy. He decided, you know, I'm going to take my wife, it was a big anniversary, I'm going to take her off to some place. Right, I forgot exactly the location, but it was one of those, you know, out there places. And he was debating it, should I do it? Is it an appropriate thing to do? He talked it over with his rav. This is okay for us to go there. I'm worried maybe there won't be minyanim, right? And the rav decided, based on the shalom bayis cheshbon, he said, you know, do it. Make your wife happy, go. So he goes there, and he's amazed because he went to this kosher hotel, okay, good, and there's a minyan. And there's a minyan three times a day. It's great. And he's not the only one, right? All these other, quote unquote, very sharp people who come to minyan, you know, they're gartel, right? Very chashuv, right? And the guy with the gartel, I hate to say it, but it was the guy with the gartel, says to him, says nothing to do with wearing a gartel, but just coincidentally, where he told the story unto me, he goes, you know, the guy with the gartel, we're talking, and he says to me, hey, you know, they got to know each other, let's go clubbing later. So my friend is like a naive guy. He shows up to the meeting, you know, he thought clubbing meant golf. So he shows up with his golf outfit and his golf clubs. And I don't know exactly what clubbing means. I mean it seriously, even though, you know, whatever. But I really don't know, but obviously it means something else. Right? And boy, was he shocked when he found out what it meant. So he says to me, could you believe this? Here's all these guys, you know, they're so concerned with the Yonim and Zmanim. Oh, the Zman, there's so much, you know. And so I said to the guy, I go, what? What do you want to do? And the guy said, what do you mean? It's not us, sir. So, but what kind of attitude does he project? What is what kind of Torah value is that? So when we talk about a real Torah life, let's be sure that what we're talking about is not only the rules of the game, but the game itself. To really live a Torah life, it doesn't mean you can get an expression that really scares you. Right? I've heard this from people that they call the person calls himself, I'm an observant secular Jew. An observant secular Jew. What on earth is that mean? You know what it means? It means that I really want to live a secular life, I'm all about secularity, but I'll follow the rules. Right? And to me, Torah life means just, where the lines are drawn, but you can think, feel, have attitudes, be motivated towards anything you want. So that's like such a mistake. That's such stupidity. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as an observant secular Jew. You're either a Torah Jew or not a Torah Jew. And if you're a Torah Jew, you're not secular. You hear that? You're not secular. You can't be. A Torah Jew has an attitude. He has a conviction. He's motivated wherever he is. Right? If he wants to make it real life and the real world, wherever he is the same perspective. I'm going to be focused towards that relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I'm going to be focused towards promoting and living my Torah values. So, finally, I'm understanding what real life really is. That's real life. That's the real world. Now, you should know, by the way, that Torah life and real life and this is not just reserved for people who sit all day in this medrash and are in chino for learning all day. A person could be a fully intact, living a real Torah life, even if they're doing other things. Unbelievable, right? How far does this go? There is a tshuva from the Rosh, and there's a very famous tshuva from the Ramah, two very, very significant posts, where they write, there's a shayla about calling somebody Torasa Umasa. Now, Torasa Umasa means you are a person whose essence and livelihood is Torah. You're all about Torah. And there are many halachic nafkaminas. If you read the title to Rasul Nasa, right? One, it could be that there are certain taxes you don't have to pay, certain
certain general public achrayus that you don't have to contribute to because Torah so musa.
So the Ramah and the Rush are trying to define, so who is it that constitutes Torah musa? Is it Rav Shimon bar Yochai? That's it? Something like that?
So they say no.
Kol Adam, Shirosh Adeshem, right? The person who wants to spend all his days, the days Hashem, Kol Yimei Chayav, that's what they quote.
That's who it is. And then they start to describe the person. It's a person who does his part now, so he does what he has to do, but his motivations and his thoughts all the time are towards being involved in Torah, being involved in the Kodesh Baruch Hu.
And then the moment they say, well, of course they'll learn, but it's amazing to me that they pick as their definition of Torah Su Nasa, the type of people that wouldn't have been at the top of my mind when I was going to define it. And I think it's a very important yisod because it emphasizes that attitude, conviction, is really the most important thing in creating a person who's living Torah Su Nasa, living a Torah life that's a real life. So the truth is, it doesn't matter the geographical location, the time in your life. If you want to live a real life, you do it right then and there by having these convictions and these motivations. It isn't that this life over here is some kind of preparation, some kind of virtual reality, some kind of like vacation or Disney World, right? It's none of that. It's every point in your life you're going to be approaching it sort of in the same way. What's the big challenge? The challenge is, whatever the situation that you're thrust into, are you making it real life or not? Hashem gives you the choice. It's a bechira. Haydosi b'chem hayom es hashamayim es haaretz, hachayim v'hamavis, nasati lefanecha habracha v'aklala, u'bacharta b'chayim, l'man tichya atav zarecha.
The Torah really spells it out. In every aspect of your life, wherever you are, whether it's going to be next year here, or next year in college, or next year wherever you are, or here this year, or any setting you find yourself, you have a choice of choosing life. And choosing life means to make it real, and the way you do it is to project all those attitudes. So if you're in college, you can focus on your education, you can focus on your parnasa, but you should certainly be with that, focusing on Talmud Torah, Avodas Hashem, Tefillah, Mitzvot, Chesed, because that should always be the priority. That's how you live a real life. Otherwise, you're not going to live a real life. Now, it's interesting when you really pay careful attention to the way the Torah presents this choice we all have, whether we make life or we make virtualness. It says, "Ubacharta b'chayim l'man tichya ata b'zarech." So what's strange about that expression? Ubacharta b'chayim l'man tichya. No, Ian? What's strange about that? Ubacharta b'chayim, what does it mean? Choose life so you live. Well, that sounds a little redundant, no? Or obvious. Choose life and you'll live. As opposed to what? Choose life and you'll die? What could it mean? Furthermore, what if you don't choose life? Then what happens? You die? If I'm defining life, and real life is a commitment to the things we spoke about, if I choose it, I live, okay, life. And if I don't, I die. What exactly is pshat? So, I think the one who won't be on this really beautifully, I don't remember how many years ago it was, but not too long ago at NYU, there was a major controversy. That could be just about, this controversy involved, someone wanted to start a Greek fraternity in NYU. They should have a fraternity. So, and of all times, it came out when? They come out, we have a Greek fraternity. So there was an uproar, as you might imagine, the Rosh Yeshiva were not exactly into it. And Ramam Khan, I think it was Ramam Khan, gave a fiery polemic against this. And I don't remember all the details. I'd like to do chazara on it because I remember I really liked it. But there's one thing he emphasized in it, one line that I will never forget. He was describing those who choose to give up Torah life, real life, for Greek fraternity life, whatever on earth that is, right? And he said, you know what? I think of no better pasuk to apply to them, v'yechol achar ha-hevel v'yehabalu. That's them. What does that mean? V'yechol achar ha-hevel. It's from Yirmiyahu. And it's an incredibly powerful statement. I will never forget this.
It means that those that go after hevel, vanity, illusions, nothing, they become part of it. They actually become part of the hevel. The
bottom line he emphasizes, let's know that is exactly the same point that we were just making before. He said, you know, in life you have choices. There's circumstances, everyone's had different circumstances they've been presented with, wherever they are, whatever time, and he said exactly those words. And then you have a choice. You could choose the realities of the life, which he defined from Ados to Rebbe Nosson, or you could choose the heaven. And if you choose the realities, you'll come to life, because you'll be living life. But if you choose the hevel, you'll lose your existence. You won't exist anymore. You won't exist as an independent entity. You're going to melt away and fail to be an individual person anymore. So I'm saying, wow, that reminds me of something. Isha halacha, an halachic man, the rug ends off the sefer with exactly the same result. And I think this really answers up the question of what does it mean that if you are bocher b'chayim, you'll live, but if you don't, you will cease to exist. You will be right after the hevel and made a b'chayim, you have made it b'chayim. You'll become part of it. What does it mean? The Rav says the following. Man at times exists solely by virtue of the species, by virtue of the fact that he was born a member of the human species. And its general form is engraved upon him. A person is born a person, right? And that's at the lowest level. That's what a person is. He exists solely on account of his participation in the idea of the universal. He himself, however, has never done anything that could serve to legitimate his existence as an individual. His soul, his spirit, his entire being, all are grounded in the realm of the universal. His roots lie deep in the soil of a faceless mediocrity. His growth takes place solely within the public domain. He only cares about what it looks like to the public. He has no stature of his own, no original, individual, personal profile. He has never, ever accomplished anything of his own. He's receptive, passive, where he sounded really ugly, right? A spiritual parasite, wholly under the influence of other people and their views. Never has he sought to render an accounting of himself, his relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to fellow man. He lives unnoticed and he dies unmourned. Like a fleeting cloud, a shadow, he passes through life and is gone. He bequeaths nothing for future generations, but dies, as you're ready to cry, without leaving a trace of his having lived. Empty-handed, he goes to the grave, bereft of mitzvos, of chesed. For while living, he lacked any sense of the historical responsibility and was totally wanting in any ethical passion. He was born against his will, and it is for this reason, and this reason alone, that he involuntarily lives out his life until he dies against his will as well. This is man as the random example of the biological species. Wow, so very scary description of one possible way a man could go. This description of the Rav hit home with me in an incredible way
when I was in my third year of medical school. This is an amazing story to really illustrate what the Rav is describing here. There was, in your third year of medical school, you do clerkships, which means you get exposed to all the different clinical types of medicine, even the ones you don't have any interest in. So one of them is psychology. So it's Chatayim and Maskeryom. Back then, I had zero interest in psychology. Right? I just wasn't interested. That changed. You'll see why. But I had to do it. So I did my 6 weeks of psychology. The way it worked was you were assigned a patient. And your whole assessment and evaluation, which means a lot, was going to be on your coming to a diagnosis on this particular patient. So I was up to this old man, he was an older man, and he was suffering from a form of depression. And his story is that he was actually raised in a farm home when he was little. And then early on, about 12, 13 years of age, he went off the derech completely. It wasn't for him. And this was at a time when it was very common, right? And he lived his life, basically a secular life, and somewhat hedonistically. He was that kind of guy. And he now was towards the end of his life, and he was extremely, extremely depressed. Now, when it comes to depression, right, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is certainly out of my expertise, the teaching has changed. The teaching, like when I was in medical school, you know, a couple of years ago, right, whenever it was that there are two types of depression, something called endogenous depression and exogenous. The difference is understood to be endogenous depression means it's biological or genetic. It's a biochemical imbalance. The way it's primarily treated was medication, right? That was the way you were going to, that's the only way you were going to get anywhere with this type of depression. And then the feeling or the teaching was there's a completely different type of depression called reactive depression or exogenous, which means, no, it's not so biochemical, it's not so ingrained. It's really a reaction to events of your life that one could view as appropriately depressing. But you still need treatment, but it's not medication so much. Back then the teaching was go with, you know, therapy, cognitive therapy, speak to someone, go on the couch, whatever it is, right? So my challenge as the medical student was to come up with the diagnosis. Is this guy, it was obvious he was depressed. He was absolutely miserable. I didn't need to be a rocket scientist to tell him this guy was depressed. But was it endogenous or exogenous? So I was positive of my diagnosis. I said, this guy is exogenous. It's exogenous depression. And I proudly went to the preceptor, who was going to decide my entire future and fate. I told him, it's exogenous depression. He goes, no, it's endogenous. I go, what? And we had a big fight and a big debate. Ultimately, going before the chairman of the department, who sided with me. Now, what was the issue? So, again, assuming exogenous and endogenous are defined the way I did before, the guy told me his whole story. We got very close. I had 6 weeks, twice a week, meeting with him. And he told me that here he is, he lived his whole life, and he did all these things. Same thing he told the priest, right? He lived his life pretty neutral, right? He didn't do anything terrible. And he lived a lot for his vacations, right? He worked hard. You know, it wasn't like he enjoyed getting up every day to work. But he went to work, and he basically was motivated to get to the weekend, to get to the vacation, right? And then he did, like, he got drunk, or he did various little recreational activities, and he spent his life doing that very successfully, made a lot of money, had a very nice life. And now, at the end of his life, he feels that he's got nothing. He feels he's empty. He feels he's leaving nothing. He accomplished nothing. And it's hitting him like a ton of bricks. And he's therefore very depressed. So to me, I said, yeah, I would be too. Boy, if I lived that life, and I really accomplished nothing inside, I accomplished nothing with myself. Nothing glorious with myself, just building a personality, building the Torah personality, having a real life, I would feel really miserable. And that's what the Rebbe was just describing. So it's exogenous depression. In other words, he was depressed for a reason, with the anxiety. Now the preceptor was coming from another planet. He doesn't look at it that way. He looked at this guy's life like a normal life, right? He has no reason to be depressed. He accomplished a lot, he made a lot of money, he did all these things. What do you mean it's empty? What do you mean? So in Baruch Hashem, the preceptor had to be a firm, the chairman was a firm guy. So I won. Right? But the Yesod is exactly what the Salvation is talking about. He says a person could be approaching his entire life, whatever the circumstances, whatever country he's in, at whatever point, and if he's not looking to build himself through the prism of Torah, he's going to end up without a real life. He's going to end up with something that leaves him vacuous and empty. However, we'll end with this. There is still, the Rav points out, another option available. There is another man. One who does not require the assistance of others, who does not need the support of the species to legitimate his existence. Such a man is no longer a prisoner of time, but is his own master. He exists not by virtue of the species, but solely on account of his own individual value and worth, all that he's accomplished in himself. His life is replete with creation and renewal, cognition and profound understanding. He lives not on account of having been born, but for the sake of life itself, and so that he may merit thereby the life of Olam Haba. He recognizes the destiny that is his obligation and task in life. He understands full well the dualism running through his being and that he has to make a choice. He knows that there are two paths before him and that whichever he shall choose, there must he go. He's not passive, but he's active. His personality is not receptive, but spontaneous. He does not simply abandon himself to the rule of the species, but blazes his own individual trail. He's an individual that influences the many, and his whole existence, like some enchanted stream, this is love, classic, poetic, some enchanted stream rushes ever onward to distant magical regions. He's dynamic, not static, does not remain at rest, but moves forward in an ever-ascending climb, for indeed, it is the living God for whom he pines and longs. This is the man of God who's living the real life. So, with that, I'd just like to end that we should all be zocha to make the right choice. You know, there's no such thing as here is just like some kind of temporary place to gather a few positives and bring it over to the real life. Real life is wherever you make it real. Real life is wherever you have to make it real. It's going to be every moment of your lives is going to be a moment of deciding, am I going to make it real life? B'char b'chayim? V'tichvia? Or am I going to go after the hevel, the yavalu? Chas v'chalil, that it should ever go that way. And I'm confident, based on what I've seen in this yeshiva, that everyone here will be moving in an absolutely upward, positive direction.
Tomorrow,